WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio presents Lehigh Valley Discourse. Provocative, informative, and newsworthy, Lehigh Valley Discourse brings you the people and the issues that move and shape our region here on WDIY.
Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Karen Elchar. My program this evening encompasses conservation vis-a-vis birds, in particular chimney swifts and bats. So we'll begin with bird conservation, and I'm very pleased to welcome my two guests. We have Jenny Gilrain. She is a bird conservation advocate, leader of the Save Our Swifts movement, and a member of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we also have Scott Burnett. He is the Habitat Chair for the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, and I'm very pleased that you're joining us, Scott.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So we're talking about chimney swifts primarily. So they've been in our local news for, oh gosh, it seems several months, in fact, for the past several months. So, Scott, we're doing conservation efforts. Can you talk about the birds themselves, like their benefits to humans, environment?
Sure. The chimney swift is a very unique, kind of an enigmatic bird. It's not well understood by most people. But once you learn a little bit about it, it's a very intriguing species. These birds are small, about 4 inches long, but they have a large wingspan of 11 inches with very long curved wings. So they're very aeronautical in flight. They're very capable of executing high-speed maneuvers, turns. The reason that they're very interesting, first of all, is they spend their winters in northwestern South America, and then come back here in the spring to nest and produce young. They're returning to our area right now as we speak, and they have adapted to using just chimneys, man-made chimneys, as their nesting and roosting areas. They enter the chimneys in the evening to sleep for the night, and they can only cling to vertical surfaces. They cannot perch on twigs, branches, or flat surfaces. So they spend the night in these chimneys clinging to the walls because their feet are adapted to such a surface. They have very curved toes with very long claws. They cannot open them far enough to grip a branch. So they spend the night in these chimneys. They go out first thing in the morning, and they spend the entire day on the wing because they cannot land. And they're beneficial to humans because they spend the whole day eating pest insects of various different types. One of the big ones that we admire them for is that they eat a lot of mosquitoes. Each particular bird can consume up to 1,000 mosquitoes per day.
Nice.
So they're very beneficial. They really take the burden of applying pesticides and chemicals to public areas, and they're really our friends. They live amongst us, and they perform a very beneficial service to us. They don't live very long. They've short-lived. And they have a slow reproduction rate. They only produce one nest per year per pair, if that. And the average number of eggs is 4 per nest per year. Problem is that over the last 50 years or so, 60 years, their population has decreased by 72%. Mm-hmm. So they are not producing enough offspring to counteract the losses from old age, etc. Two main things are causing the demise of the swifts. One is the removal and or capping of existing chimneys, especially older industrial-type chimneys that are brick and reaching their age limit, so they're being torn down. These are the big roosts where we see thousands of birds entering that chimney each night. They're also very susceptible to pesticides. If we overuse pesticides and the insects they eat are contaminated, they too will succumb and or pass this on to their young. So over-application of pesticides is a big problem with swift populations, as well as the removal or making chimneys unusable for the swifts to nest or roost in.
Okay, and speaking of which, so going on to a movement that Jenny has been involved in. So you've had this effort regarding a project in Bethlehem. Therefore, part of it is obviously trying to maintain portions of, in this case, the Masonic Temple, quite frankly. So how did that come about? Jenny, do you want to address how you found out about the project?
Sure. I am not nearly as informed about the Swifts as Scott is, although I'm quickly learning more and more every day. I discovered the birds in my, I live in South Bethlehem, which is an urban neighborhood, and these birds fly very high in the sky. And I noticed them and tried to figure out what they were, and then finally figured that they were chimney swifts. And my husband and I went on a mission to find where they were roosting. And we found that there is a chimney two blocks from our house, the Masonic Temple chimney, 202 Wyandotte Street in Bethlehem, where thousands of chimney swifts were going at dusk in the evening in August this past year. And it was such a beautiful sight to see them go in the chimney that we invited friends and family to come see the site. At that time, construction had not started. The redevelopment had not begun yet at the Masonic Temple. So, you know, the parking lot was just kind of an empty lot, and we would invite bunches of people to see the site at dusk in August. And one day, a little later in the year, I was taking a walk in the neighborhood and noticed a chain link fence had been put up surrounding the entire Masonic Temple, Wilbur Mansion, that entire area, with construction signs. And I realized that I had heard that the Masonic Temple was slated for demolition, so I realized it was about to begin. And I got in touch with Christine Usler, who is the architect for the project, and she put me in touch with John Noble, who is the property owner and developer for the redevelopment project. And he gave me a call, and he said, "I hear I have some birds in my chimney. What? Tell me more." And I honestly was afraid to tell him all about the birds because I was so afraid that he would want to get rid of the problem by getting rid of the birds. And it turned out to be quite the opposite. John Noble is the hero of the story. And yeah, I'll let Scott tell you the next part where Scott actually met John on site. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Jenny was instrumental in putting this whole meeting of the minds together. She spoke with Mr. Noble and then set up a meeting between a bunch of concerned parties, myself included, so that we could all bang heads about what were the options in this situation. So I brought my knowledge of Swifts along, and I kind of informed John as to just what these birds are, what they do, the benefits they present, and gave him some options of how he could help the Swifts without getting rid of the chimney or having to do any kind of major changes to his development plan. And after about an hour or so on site, John said, this will stick with me forever. John said, we're going to save these birds here and their habitat no matter what it takes. And I thought, wow, this is so unique, because mm-hmm. I was totally expecting to get a brush off and say, well, that's economically unfeasible. So John really is a unique individual in that he was willing to listen to what we had to say and offer solutions that he could implement in order to save the Swifts that were there. And we're talking, you know, tens of thousands of Swifts using that particular single chimney throughout the course of a migration period. So it was not a slight amount of birds that we were talking about. It was a whole population. It was a generations of Swifts that we were trying to save. Mm-hmm. And John was right on board. I mean, he lived true to his name. He was noble about it. He was more than willing to do whatever it took to save these birds. And I thought, wow, this is wonderful. This is unprecedented in my field, you know, to have a developer mm-hmm. actually change his plans to accommodate mm-hmm. a species. Here we are at this time. The mm-hmm. building has been torn down, but the chimney remains. And John is planning on building another building around it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so it will be left as is, pretty much. So the Swifts will recognize their old roosts, come right back again in the fall this year, I'm sure. I don't think the project will be finished in time for spring nesting, but a pair or two might still use the chimney this year yet. They're just arriving now, like I said, and Jenny's been out and seen some flying in her neighborhood, so it's very encouraging to think that the birds are already maybe using the chimney again.
Will it have an impact, whatever he's doing around the chimney? Do you think that would have an impact on the birds themselves, or is it mostly they don't really care? They just want to come back to their chimney?
Yeah, these swifts memorize the chimneys that they use during their migration route. Uh-huh. And this is learned by generation after generation. As the babies follow their parents in migration, they learn the chimneys that they stop off on, you know, Tuesday, and then Thursday they'll move further south, and they remember the chimney they stop at next. And the whole line of chimneys on their migration route is put to memory. And these birds really can home in on a chimney almost, you know, blindly. They have senses that humans don't possess. They can feel the Earth's magnetic fields. They can hear distant sounds of the ocean hundreds or thousands of miles away. They're incredible animals, and by leaving their existing chimney intact rather than building a new one, the structure is totally recognized by them, and therefore they will adapt right back to it as soon as they come back in the spring. So we're looking forward to having a swift watch over there very soon, and at least watch them go in for nesting and so forth.
What an excellent opportunity. If you're just joining us, let me reintroduce my guests. I'm pleased to have with me this evening Jenny Gilrain, bird conservation advocate, leader of the Save Our Swifts movement, and member of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, as well as Scott Burnett, habitat chair of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're going to take a brief break. Do stay tuned.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. My name is Karen Elchar, your host this evening. And if you're just joining us, I'm pleased to have my guest, Jenny Gilrain. She is a bird conservation advocate, leader of the Save Our Swifts movement, and a member of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, as well as Scott Burnett, who is habitat chair of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. We were talking earlier about chimney swifts themselves, their habitat, benefit to society and the environment, etc. Let's talk a little bit about this, the educational component of what Jenny has been doing to enlighten particularly the residents of Bethlehem. Jenny, can you expound a bit on the various activities? I know Scott's been doing presentations at the Bethlehem Library, but what else have you done?
Yes, well, the community has been crucial to this whole project, and I think it's a bit of a fairy tale story, a true fairy tale story in the way that the community has come together to advocate for these birds. So when I first realized that the chimney was in danger of being demolished, I contacted John as well as a whole bunch of community members, including the Environmental Advisory Council of Bethlehem City Government, Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, Sierra Club Lehigh Valley, Lehigh University, environmental science professors, English professors, community members, and we actually had a Zoom meeting way back in December of 2020 and just kind of brainstormed what can we do to help save this particular chimney? And then second step, how can we raise awareness in the community? We wrote a grant, and the Lehigh Valley Engaged Humanities Consortium funded a series of 3 public forums hosted by the Bethlehem Mary Public Library. Scott educated us about the birds in the first forum, and Peter Sanger and Christine Usler and Scott told us about their habitat in the second forum. And the third forum, which was a panel discussion, happened last night, and we had 6 different people on the panel, one of whom was John Noble, Peter Sanger and Scott Burnett, and Lynn Rothman of the EAC in Bethlehem, Environmental Advisory Council, and a couple of Lehigh environmental professors, Brina Highland and Karen Beck Pooley, and one of my fourth grade students.
Oh, my.
Who is just a doll. Her name is Emma Huertes. And yeah, I am a fourth grade teacher, and when I get passionate about something, I usually bring it into my classroom. So my students this year, each of them wrote a letter to the Bethlehem City Council advocating for the chimney swift and asking the Bethlehem City Council to name the chimney swift the Bird of Bethlehem. Yeah. And then, yeah, 3 of my students actually attended the city council meeting back in February, you know, virtually, and read their letters aloud to the council. And Olga Negron penned a request to name the Bird of Bethlehem, which the council all voted unanimously to do. So it is a symbolic gesture, which now we're following up with some real activity to try to save the roost, such as Masonic Temple, which is already a done deal, and other roosts, as well as build new habitat mm-hmm. for the swifts in parks and playgrounds, as I know you've done in Allentown, and Scott has been a big part of. So again, I'll pass it on to him.
Yes, Jenny's outreach to the community really was the spark that made this whole thing possible. I'm just a guy who likes swifts. And, you know, I have the experience with working with these birds in conservation situations. And as you know, we've built several towers, artificial towers for the birds to use in the Allentown Parks Department with Karen's help. Thank mm-hmm. you very much, Karen.
Yes, thank you.
And what we're trying to do now is the education part is critical. This is how more people get involved. This is how people learn about what faces the imperiled swifts, the plight that they're up against, and how they can personally help. I will mention that we're hosting a GoFundMe campaign, fundraising campaign, through the Audubon Society right now. It's the SOS GoFundMe. You can type that in on Google and look it up. And it's got some interesting video about swifts, and some TV and news articles are in there about, you know, what's going on at the Masonic Temple. And then there's a place that you can donate to the fund.
Would you like to say what SOS stands for?
SOS stands for Save Our Swift. This is a term coined by Jenny.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, and we have little stickers available with a swift on them and SOS. And it's just a really neat project. People can get involved without doing anything. They can go to the SOS GoFundMe page and donate $1 or $5. Every bit helps. You know, it's been a roller coaster ride from the beginning, but all of this money that we raise with the GoFundMe fundraiser is going to be put towards education, educational processes and outreach. Originally, it was to reimburse Mr. Noble for his costs of saving the chimney. But he recently came to us and said, hey, he said, I don't want to be reimbursed. Just use that money to educate people and kids about swifts. So how magnanimous of him to do that.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to do. We're going to use it to build more artificial chimneys in parks and public areas, as Jenny mentioned. And there will be classes and programs and brochures and all kinds of things available in the very near future for the public to access. You can access that through the LVAS website, which is lvaudubon.org, or in various retail businesses. We'll be passing out the brochures and stuff in Bethlehem and Lehigh Valley.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest educational tools that we will have through this is Mr. Noble has agreed to allow us to install video cameras inside the chimney so we can actually live stream and watch what the swifts do day and night as they're nesting and roosting and whatever. And this will be available to everyone on various websites. It's just a really cool way to get people involved and interested. Once they see these birds in the chimney, they'll marvel at them.
So this is almost like the Eagle Cam.
Same concept. Exactly the same thing. Yes.
I just wanted to say, to credit, I actually didn't come up with SOS. Again, children come up with most of the best ideas. And two children, Matilda and Charlie Snyder, when they saw the swift and we were talking about what can we do, came up with the term SOS, Save Our Swift campaign.
Yes, children are wonderful.
Yes, they are.
Also, so you have this GoFundMe site. I believe, Scott, the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society also has an activity regarding corporate donations.
Yes, we haven't really solicited corporate donations up to this point. We've just been asking for small donations publicly. But the large corporate donors will be what really puts this over the top for us as far as funding. So the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society has kicked this around in the last two board meetings, and we pretty much are going to offer a matching funding gift where if a corporation makes a donation, Lehigh Valley Audubon will match it and put it into the fund. So I'm sending out the message now to anyone that knows of any corporate donors that might be involved. Please put the bug in their ear or get them to contact us at Lehigh Valley Audubon Society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a great way for us to have win-win-wins for everybody because these corporations end up being the heroes in all of this because they pay for it. Mm-hmm. But the birds benefit, we benefit, the public benefits. It's a win all the way around, so it's a good thing for us to get involved in, and we're going to start doing that very shortly.
Wonderful. Do you also want to mention the statewide registry?
Yes. Last year, a member of Wincote Audubon and myself, Wincote Audubon is located down in Philadelphia. The woman is also a very big lover of chimney swifts. She decided that we should start a statewide registry of all known chimneys being used by swifts for nesting or roosting. So we have a website available now where you can go on, and if you know of a place where there's a chimney being used by swifts, you can report it and add it to the registry. It's a short form, just asks a few questions. What is the location of the chimney? What's it made of? How big is it? How many birds did you see using it? Stuff like that. Very simple information that you can enter, and then it will go into the state registry. And this helps us, this data helps us as a tool to recognize chimneys that might be getting ready to be torn down, that we can approach landowners and try some conservation efforts with them. And just knowing where these chimneys are, where they're concentrated in great numbers, helps us to know where we're going to find the most swifts and be able to do the most good. So that website, I don't remember offhand, but you can get it by going to the lvaudubon.org main website, and it will be posted in there. Mm-hmm. And then you can access that from a click link right from our website.
Mm-hmm.
So please think about that in the future. The birds are coming back now. So any additions to the registry are more than welcome, and this is how we'll move forward on preserving the species.
Let me also mention, Lehigh Valley Audubon also has a Facebook page in addition to the website. And I also understand you are doing a Zoom program on May 7th.
Correct. I'll be hosting about an hour and a half long program strictly on the chimney swifts, everything from A to Z about them, and focusing mainly on their conservation. So that will be held May 7th at 7 p.m. via Zoom. You need to pre-register and get a link to join the meeting. And that information will be available on the LVAS, Lehigh Valley Audubon Society, Facebook page in the coming week. So if you're interested in seeing that program, please go to our Facebook page and type in Swift program in the search box, and it'll take you right to the post about linking into the meeting.
So before we close out, is there anything else that either of you would like our listeners to know about mini swifts, bird conservation, etc.?
I would just mention that there's a lot of citizen science that can be done regarding the chimney swifts. Just get out there and look for them in the evenings.
Mm-hmm.
Check new chimneys. See if you can sight swifts. Record where you see them. Send the information to us, because we're going to be the boots on the ground that eventually help, you know, do the conservation work. There's no better feeling than helping a species that cannot help itself and is at the hands of human demise. So these birds are pretty helpless, you know, to do things on their own. They rely on us for homes and safe food, and it's the least we can do to give them the respect they're due and conserve the population.
Thank you. And Jenny, comments from you?
Yes, I'm excited about a project that will happen next year in which my school, Freemansburg Elementary School, fourth grade, is going to connect with an elementary school on the other end of the migratory path in Peru and in Bolivia, and we're going to exchange information about the swifts that we observe and write poetry about the swifts and exchange that as well virtually via Zoom. I'm so excited about it.
Oh, I think those are wonderful opportunities. So I'm very pleased that you joined us tonight. So once again, so my thanks to Jenny Gilrain. She is a bird conservation advocate, leader of the Save Our Swifts movement, and a member of Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. Jenny, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program this evening. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen.
And also Scott Burnett, Habitat Chair of the Lehigh Valley Audubon Society. Scott, it's always wonderful having bird conservation discussions with you. Thank you.
Yes, Karen, and thank you for being such a strong advocate for the swifts.
And thanks to our listeners for joining us this evening. Coming up next, I welcome Sarah Bouboulis, bat biologist, where we'll talk about bat conservation. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Do stay tuned.
Connect to WDIY with our new app. Download for free from the Apple or Google Store and enjoy the great music, news, and programs you love on the go. The easy-to-use app is where you can listen to WDIY Live or your favorite music shows on demand with our two-week archive feature. Download and share the WDIY app with your friends and family and introduce them to many choices, real voices.
WDIY is Lehigh Valley Public Radio at 88.1 FM, also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For more local news and information, public affairs, and links to NPR programs, visit our website, wdiy.org.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY, Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11, offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
WDIY Lehigh Valley Public Radio, your trusted local NPR member station for over 25 years. Many choices, real voices.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. My name is Karen Elchar. It's my pleasure to be your host this evening. We're going to talk about bats. My guest is Sarah Bouboulis. She's the Habitat Project Coordinator for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. She is an ecologist with a major passion for bats. She's also studied bat conservation and disease ecology for her bachelor's degree, which she received at East Stroudsburg University, as well as her master's degree at Bucknell University. Since that point, she's worked for the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She's working on a variety of bat research and conservation work, as well as other threatened species and habitat projects. She works for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary throughout the tri-state area on clean water initiatives and with a focus on habitat restoration. So, Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Karen. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I am extremely passionate about bats, as you are. So we're talking bat conservation. How did you get interested in bats?
Yeah, but I think a lot of people don't go into school thinking, I'm going to study bats. They're kind of a niche topic. But I knew I wanted to be a biologist going into college, and I took a mammalogy class, and who doesn't like furry things, right? Mm-hmm. So I went in to mammalogy knowing that I really loved mammals, and the professor of that class was really engaging, and he had an opening for some undergraduates in his lab, and he happened to study bats, and I had the option between two projects. It was bats, or foals, red-backed foals, which are also very cute and a nice species. And I kind of had the option there, and I chose bats, and it kind of really became a big part of my life, that decision. So that's how I got started with bats. I did undergraduate work on bats and the effect of wind turbines have on bat populations. And after that, I went to grad school, and white-nose syndrome that we're going to talk a lot about, I'm sure, later, was a really hot topic right at that time. A lot of people were beginning to study that, and including Bucknell University and Dr. Deanne Reeder out of Bucknell. And so I went to join her lab, where I kept working with bats, and it kind of just flew from there. It just kept going, and bat opportunities became available. So that's where it really started. So it wasn't like I need to study bats. They kind of just fell into my lap. But I'm a rabbit hole person. Once I learn about something, I go down, I go deep, I learn everything I can about them. And ever since then, I've been really, really into that.
So. Excellent. So when we talk about bats, I know in some instances people are concerned about being around bats. Sometimes bats have a bad reputation and people are frightened of them, etc. But can you talk a little bit about the bats? I mean, they're very beneficial to the environment, beneficial to humans, etc.
Yeah, so I just will start that. I get it. I get why bats are a little weird. They're like, they fly, they're pretty small, they get into your houses sometimes. I get where, like, the fear comes from. But I think once you learn a little more about them and how beneficial they are, you know, we can help dissipate that fear. So bats first, a lot of people think they're flying mice. They're not rodents at all. They're not related. They're in their own order, Chiroptera, which means hand wing, because their hand has become their wing. And they're the only group of, you know, of mammals with true flight, which is really cool, I think. And, you know, they're filling kind of that nighttime flying, you know, the birds fly at daytime and the bats are flying at nighttime. Next to rodents, they have most number of species than any other group of mammals. Worldwide, there's 1,500 species of bats. Here in Pennsylvania, there's only, I think it's 8 or 9. And they're really important because of the role they play. They fly at night eating all these insects. All the bats in Pennsylvania are insect-eating bats, and they primarily eat moths and beetles, which are a lot of our major crop pests in agriculture. So they're doing a huge service by eating all those insects. They also eat mosquitoes and other insects that we may not like flying around us. They also just generally have this important role within the ecosystem as being both predator and prey. They are prey to other creatures. I generally say whatever can find a bat will eat it, but it's hard to find them. Not everything can catch them, but owls, other birds of prey will eat them. Snakes will eat them. Really anything that can find a bat will probably eat them. So they play an important role for insect control is really the big one.
So would you say, are bats migratory, or do they stay in one place all the time? Where do they go?
So in Pennsylvania, we have two kind of different groups of bats. We have our migratory bats and what we call our cave bats. And our most common bats are big brown bats. That's the most common bat in the area. And they are cave bats, which means they, in the winter, they hibernate in caves. And in the summer, those are the ones that you're going to find in a bat box or in your house. And so they're also sometimes called house bats. So they will move around a little bit throughout the year, and particularly from their cave in the winter to their summer roost in the summer and then again in the fall. But they generally stay in kind of the same area. They can go pretty far, but not as far as our migratory bats. And our migratory bats, the most common migratory bat is the eastern red bat. They're also pretty common. And they generally migrate further than the house bats. That's generally what they do. And they hibernate alone, while the cave bats, both in the summer and winter, will be all together in big groups. The migratory bats are generally solitary. They hibernate and have their summer in the forest. They hang out in trees during the summer. And then in the winter, their hibernation pattern can vary, but sometimes they'll often hibernate in the leaf litter on the floor in the winter, so you may see them if you're hiking around the woods. Possibility. There's a couple of fewer species of those, but than our cave bats.
So for the most part, here in the Lehigh Valley, most often we see the bats coming in. What would you say, May-ish, and they hang out with us till when they leave again at some point.
Generally, a hibernation period is considered October to April. Is when they hibernate, and then so May to September. The caves that they hibernate in are still, quote-unquote, here. They're really not that far away. There are plenty of caves in Pennsylvania that they'll go to, but when you see them, more likely is going to be, in the summer.
For the most part, summertime, because we don't want to disturb the bats when they go into their caves during the wintertime.
Right. Either. You don't disturb them at any time, but less, they're also not all about flying when they're hibernating. They're just mostly in the cave.
And for our listeners, I just wanted to mention my guest is Sarah Bouboulis. She is a Habitat Project Coordinator for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary, and we're talking bat conservation. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. We're going to take a brief break. Do stay tuned.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax-deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Galactic Travels brings you hour-long soundscapes of electronic, ambient, and space music. That's Thursday night at 11, right here on WDIY Allentown, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Many choices, real voices.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Sarah Bouboulis. She's a Habitat Project Coordinator. She's an ecologist. She studied bat conservation and disease ecology. She has both a bachelor's and a master's degree. She's worked for the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, working on a variety of bat research and conservation work, as well as other threatened species and habitat projects. She works for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary throughout the tri-state area on clean water with a focus on habitat restoration. So, Sarah, I'm very appreciative that you're joining us, and I'd like to continue. We were talking about bats and also being in caves. They winter over, our bats here in the Lehigh Valley frequently winter over in caves, and I know there's a disease which has afflicted some bats. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. So the disease is called white nose syndrome, and it was first found in cave bats in 2006 in Albany, New York. And since then, it has spread far and wide across the United States, affecting about 12 species of bats in the United States. All of them are hibernating cave bats. It's a fungal infection that affects them while they're hibernating. It kind of invades their pores on their skin and causes a slew of afflictions from messing up with their hibernation rhythms, making them then lose weight, and eventually leading primarily to their death.
Sarah, pardon the interruption, but how does white nose syndrome affect the bat's natural hibernation cycle?
There's a lot of pathways it can then take to cause death in bats, but there's one fairly common one, and that's when the fungus causes them to come out of their hibernation state. And every time a bat comes out of their hibernation state, it costs them energy. They do it, and without the fungus, they will come out of hibernation occasionally during the winter to go to the bathroom, to get water, but the more they do that, the more fat they use up. And there's no insects for them to eat, generally, in the winter. So if they're using all this extra fat, it eventually can cause them to starve to death because there's no food, and they're waking up more frequently with the fungus than they would during a normal winter. So that's the most common path of death for these bats with white nose. But there are some other things it affects as well, just like causes skin irritation and some other pathways as well.
I was just going to ask, so some bats are affected by white nose syndrome, but not all bats are affected. Is there, through your research and the activities you've done, can it be determined why some are more affected than others or not at all affected?
Yeah, that's still actually a pretty big question. And I don't think anyone has a solid answer on that. It's both. So first, it only affects the cave bats. So I talked about earlier, there's cave bats and migratory bats. This fungus is a cold, humid-loving fungus, which is perfect for caves. And so the migratory bats don't live in those environments in the winter, and so they're not affected by the fungus. So that's one. So that's about maybe half of our bats that are migratory and not affected by the fungus. But there are cave bats that are also not as affected by the fungus, including what is now our most common bat because of white nose. Little brown bats used to be our most common bat. And due to white nose, their populations have been like 99% wiped out in some locations. And since 2006, 2007-ish, in Pennsylvania, where these populations declined really hit hard. And since then, big brown bats have become kind of our most common bat, and the white nose doesn't seem to affect them as much. It does affect them, but not as much. And why is that? That's still kind of a big question. It could be because of their size. They're able to their natural immunities, their hibernation patterns. They're generally store more fat for the winter. There are a lot of reasons, so each species is going to probably be fending off this fungus in a different way.
So the 1% of little brown bats that, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, remain, mm-hmm. I believe we had a prior conversation where we talked about mm-hmm. that 1% is basically going to repopulate the little brown bat mm-hmm. population. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. So white nose has really done its most damage it's going to do here in Pennsylvania. And so it's still here, though. It's still here, and bats can get infected by it year after year. But there are some bats with 1%, or we're not sure the exact number, but 1%, and they are still surviving. And there's a lot of research going on to why and how they're surviving. And if they continue to be infected by white nose, does that really affect their chances of long-term survival? A lot of research is going into that. And then their ability to reproduce. And then if you're still using more of your fat every year because you have this fungus, you might not then have enough fat to reproduce, which is a big issue. And then if you do reproduce, if you do happen to reproduce, what immunities are you passing on to the pups? And will they just die the next winter because the white nose is still here? So all of these questions are definitely being researched and looked at intensely.
So we know now the bats are susceptible. Some species of bats are susceptible to white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. Is the white nose syndrome something that can be transmitted to humans or other animals?
Not in any detrimental way. I think it has been shown that it shows up in some other locations, but not in any sort of detrimental way. It's really this cold, and once it is exposed to high temperatures, it dies. And so there are a lot of treatments that are being researched for the bats as well, but it's a really tricky business because you not only want to be able to cure the bats, but you don't want it to harm anything else in these very specific habitats of the cave that these bats are looking in, that they're living in. So there's been looking at biological controls, like antifungal type things, different chemicals, maybe a vaccine, genetic options for helping, you know, the population over the long term. So tons of different treatments are being looked at for bats, but it probably will not be a one-size-fits-all solution. We're going to have to try different things on different populations depending on the specific case of that specific population.
And for our listeners, I just wanted to mention my guest is Sarah Bouboulis, bat biologist, and we're talking about bat conservation and other issues related to bats. So, and the last question I asked was, does it really exist about transmissibility to humans, for example? I just wanted to also bring up, so on March 19th, Morning Edition ran a report, which was basically understanding where coronaviruses come from and how they enter humans. And in that regard, so we've heard now from you that it's working with our own local bats, etc., not, you know, it's not transmissible necessarily to humans, although, you know, if you're in an area where there is white nose syndrome, I mean, you might have it on your shoes, you know, wherever you might be walking, but it's not really transmissible into humans. What's your opinion about transmissibility and all this that we've heard that the coronavirus began with bats and all of that? I mean, it's giving bats a very bad reputation, quite frankly.
So I will just mention that even though humans cannot get white nose ourselves, like you said, it can be on your shoes, and we do need to be very careful, particularly cavers and things like that, about transmitting the cave from habitat to habitat, particularly on the edge of where white nose is. Here in Pennsylvania, it's pretty much all over, but if it has been eradicated, you could reintroduce it. So anyway, just be careful with that. Humans can take it places, white nose, fungus. But as far as other diseases, bats are very interesting in that they have very unique and understudied immune systems. There's a lot of people that study bats and their immune systems. Bats can harbor a range of diseases and viruses within their bodies without any signs or symptoms, really, of the disease. So it's very interesting. Even the most well-known is obviously rabies, and bats can live with rabies and not show any outward symptoms of it, but still can transmit it to people. And that just, they can also eventually show symptoms as well. But it's just very interesting in that regard. And I do believe there is a real possibility that coronavirus and a lot of these novel viruses are connected to bats. For better or worse, I think it is likely due to the different cultural practices in some areas, and their relationship with bats is very different than our relationship with bats. And then our globalization of our world to some of these communities that do use bats as a resource in different ways, and then their connection to the global world is really something that we need to look at if we want to try to curtail our exposure to some of these diseases that bats may harbor. The diseases are found, I think that article mentioned that they are found in other species as well. It's not just bats. But I think the relationship with bats that people around the world have makes us a little more plausible. And, you know, I think it's been that way for hundreds of years, just using bats as a resource around the world. It's just kind of our globalization and the greater encroachment of humans onto that habitat, you know, which increases our exposure to them. So as we change the way our relationship is with bats, that will change the way that bat diseases relationship to us. And so we just have to be mindful of that and think about that and understand that better. And I know there is a lot of research that's going into that. And I think that just needs to continue, because it certainly is real that something like coronavirus could happen again if we continue doing what we've always done, which is using bats as a resource for, you know, cultural resource, and then encroaching on their habitat and continuing, you know, the global movement of humans and bats.
Mm-hmm. So let me also ask, since you mentioned habitat, if we look at conservation activities, there are people who like bats and who want to conserve bats and want to help them, as you've spoken about how little brown bats, the population's been decimated 99%. So what can people do to actually assist in conservation efforts?
Yeah, so no matter where you are, and I think everywhere, habitat, loss of habitat is like the number one conservation issue for bats, number one for most species. And so number one thing you can do is conserve habitat. And whether that's on your own property or, you know, through funding initiatives that are supporting habitat conservation, that's number one across any species really around the world, but even bats. And because there's so many species of bats, there's 1,500, but across the world, they fill every habitat. So woods or prairies or a tropical rainforest, every sort of habitat is where bats can be found. So every habitat is important for bats. But here at home and in your backyard, things you can do are, if you know of where bats have, so in the summer, it's generally what you'll see is the maternity colonies, where the mom bats are all gathering to have their babies in these large groups. That's mostly what you'll see. And if you know of any of these colonies of bats, you can report them to the Game Commission. You can start counting them as part of called the Appalachian Bat Count here in Pennsylvania. It's a really great volunteer effort to get better information about bat populations, especially now after white nose syndrome. You can also put up a bat box in your yard, which would hopefully attract bats and this maternity colony of bats to raise their pups. I'll just say, don't be discouraged if it doesn't work. It takes a lot to get bats to move into your bat box. They have to want to. They have to be not have a better alternative somewhere nearby. They're very site-specific, so bats use both the same maternity colony and hibernation locations year after year after year, high site fidelity, it's called. And so to get them in your bat box is kind of unlikely. But I put them up anyway. You never know. You never know who's kicking the bats out of their house down the street, and maybe they'll move into your bat box. So I still say put them up. Make sure you look into the specific requirements that they need. You do want to make sure you follow kind of all the rules for our specific area to give your bat box the best shot. And make sure you have a water source. Bats really need water. Usually a bird bath is not going to cut it. Kind of a bigger pond is usually better. But also they travel, so if there's a pond or something nearby, that's also great. It doesn't have to be right in your backyard. Plant native plants, because bats eat native bugs. They'll eat other stuff too, but they certainly like native insects. So like I said, their favorites are moths and beetles. So to get the moths and beetles that they like, you have to provide habitat for those moth and beetle larvae, which is a vast array of native plants. Bats are not specific on the moths and beetles they like too much. They're generalists. So every native plant can be home to a different caterpillar that can be home to, grow into a different moth. So you plant diversity in your yard, and you will be supporting the bat's food source as well. And then finally, I'm going to say keep your cats indoors. Cat attacks are kind of the number of kind of a big threat to bats on our local landscape.
To your point, when you talked about bat boxes, I mean, you assisted as well, working with me on a particular bat conservation project where Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So they gentlemen came in to help us set up bat boxes, and I can attest we still don't have bats in those boxes. So it does take a while.
It does, and I don't think those will ever have bats in them unless something happened to where we know the bats are. We know of a nearby colony right there, and so they'll probably never move in as long as that other location is there, because they know that that's a good one.
So one additional question. We just had a bird discussion on chimney swifts, and a lot of educational opportunities, you know, here locally, for example. But where would individuals find additional information on bats and bat conservation and things like that?
Certainly the Pennsylvania Game Commission is a great resource. They do they run the Bat Count Project, Appalachian Bat Count Project, and are just a wealth of information. Bat Conservation International is a great organization as well. They work for bat conservation, right in their name, across the world, and they're really a great place if you're looking to just general information or different conservation efforts. Every state, you know, I work a lot in New Jersey and Delaware as well, and they both also have bat kind of projects going on. You can easily Google Delaware bats, New Jersey bats, and you'll find information for your local area.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you with me this evening. I always enjoy having bat conversations with you, since obviously you and I have worked together on at least one project for several years. And so it's wonderful to have you back now, actually interviewing and really talking about bats and their benefit, as well as other issues like white nose syndrome and obviously what we can do to assist in conservation efforts. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about bats or anything related?
I would just say, the more you know about bats, I think the less, you know, scary they can be. I know they can be scary, but don't freak out right away. Just get the right information and then decide, particularly if you have bats in your house or something like that. I know that can be scary. So just kind of seek out the right information, and I think it won't be quite as scary, because they need our help.
Well, Sarah, I'd like to thank you for being my guest this evening. It's been a pleasure working with you and speaking with you. And once again, for our listeners, my guest has been Sarah Bobulis. She's Habitat Project Coordinator for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary throughout the tri-state area. And it's also involving clean water initiatives with a focus on habitat restoration. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Karen. It was so good to be here. Always good talking to you. Great questions.
Thank you to all my guests, including Sarah Bobulis, Jenny Gilrain, and Scott Burnett, discussing conservation of birds and bats. Thanks also to our recording engineer, James Johnson. And to you, our listeners, thank you for joining us this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm Karen Elchar. It's been my pleasure to host this evening's program. And please join me tomorrow at 9 a.m. for WDIY Classics.